This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Johnny Pesky there, kicking things off at Fenway Park, the beloved field that John Updike famously called a lyric little bandbox of a ballpark. Any Red Sox fan can recite the triumphs and sorrows that played out at Fenway like Greek tragedies. Some years stand out to the faithful. The cursed 1918, the 68 and 75 World Series, 86, and of course, 2004. We now turn to 1912, when Fenway Park opened its doors. Glenn Stout tells a story of the idiosyncratic park's construction, christening, and enduring charm in the new book, Fenway 1912, The Birth of a Ballpark, a Championship Season, and Fenway's Remarkable First Year. He's a prolific sports writer and an editor of the Best American Sports Writing and has been enraptured with Fenway since he was a kid. He'll be talking about the book tonight at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord. Glenn Stout, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much.
Boston did have a ballpark in 1911, the Huntington Avenue grounds. Why did it need a new park?
Well, the Huntington Avenue grounds, which had been Fenway or the Red Sox home since the team began, was not owned by the Red Sox. They leased the land, and the grandstand was really small. The owner of the team, John I. Taylor, couldn't sell enough high-priced grandstand tickets for about a dollar and a half. It only seated about 2,000 people, and sometimes as many as 5,000 would show up and leave because they couldn't sit underneath the stands. They didn't want to go out with the rabble who only paid 50 cents or a quarter. So they needed a ballpark with a bigger grandstand. They also needed one that they could get insurance for, because the old ballparks were built out of wood and wood tended to burn, and insurance companies didn't want to insure them anymore. So they went with this new concrete and steel construction.
Besides giving us the players, the actual players like Tris Speaker, Hick Cady, Duffy Lewis, what a bunch of names, and the fireballer, Smokey Joe Wood, we get the owners, investors, and largely unsung James McLaughlin. Give us a little background on this city architect who designed Fenway Park.
Yeah, that was something I really had some questions about, because 25 years ago, I wrote the 75th anniversary of the park for the Red Sox yearbook and knew nothing about the architect, James McLaughlin. So this time around, I decided to find out about him. And it turns out he was Nova Scotian. He moved here with his mother after his father died, became an architect, very much self-trained. And Fenway Park was the only ballpark he ever built. Before he built Fenway, he was best known for building schools and armories and other civic buildings, taking advantage of the fact that the Irish had taken over city government in Boston, and suddenly those contracts were open to someone like McLaughlin. And so he was given the charge to build Fenway Park. And one of the reasons why Fenway still works and still fits in Boston is it's very much in feeling with many of his other buildings, which are ubiquitous throughout eastern Massachusetts. And so Fenway looks like it fits Boston because McLaughlin was one of those architects that created the look that Boston had.
And we get a feeling of Boston that's so strong in that time that Jerome Kelly, who was a groundskeeper, comes out in his neighborhood. It feels like he could be in Ireland for all he knew. And it's important to note how many of Boston's really monumental buildings were mostly in the Greek Revival style in the 10 years before Fenway was built. So give us a little background. How did it look? If you were looking out on Fenway Park, how did it fit in with the rest of the building?
Well, if you went to Fenway Park before it was built, it looked like Kansas right around Fenway, because Frederick Law Olmsted had recently completed, his wonderful signature park in the Fens, and that had drained this swampy expanse. That's what the Fens is a swamp. And on one side of it, you had these grand buildings, the Museum of Fine Arts, the Opera House, places where the Irish working men helped build but weren't always welcome. And then on the other side of the Fens, out there all by itself, except for a few garages on Lansdowne Street, was Fenway Park, a building that these Irishmen could not only help build, but it was also a place they could actually go and attend the events that took place inside. So it was very much one of Boston's first really, truly public buildings.
And some of your myths that you bust through here, many people today attribute the size of the park to having been shoehorned into the surrounding area. It was basically an open space.
Yeah, it was an open space. And what you have to keep in mind is when the ballpark was built in 1912, the game of baseball was much smaller. The game did not reach the borders of the property. Over time, in the Lively Ball era, the game expanded, and over time, the ballpark was built inward. That's why the game is a little small for the park now. But when it was Fenway Park was first built, no one ever thought someone would ever hit a ball over the left field wall.
Well, on April 9th, 1912, Fenway opened its doors. Some of the notable things that I thought were quite funny, the extravagant two toilet rooms beneath the grandstand, one for the ladies, even.
Yeah, one. Imagine that. Ladies are not only allowed to attend, but are allowed to go to the bathroom at the ballpark.
Well, now people adore these eccentric features of Fenway and you know, look at it like a Renaissance cathedral or something. Did 1912 fans have the same appreciation?
They started to have the same appreciation. I mean, they were wowed initially by the size of the ballpark. They couldn't believe that the grandstand was as big as it was, I mean, compared to the old Huntington Avenue grounds. But then again, it also took a while to grow on them because the ballpark was kind of stuck out by itself in this area of town that people weren't accustomed to going to. There weren't the bars and restaurants nearby like there is now, you know. Mm-hmm. That all had to develop. And so it took a while for people to latch on to Fenway Park. But, I mean, that's the unique thing about a ballpark is that each time you go to it, you become a little bit of an owner of it. You get some ownership in it. And over time, that's what happened to Boston fans.
We're talking about Fenway Park's first year with sports writer Glenn Stout. He's written a biography of that year called Fenway 1912. He's also the author of Red Sox Century and, dare we say, Yankee Century, among many, many other books. Well, it soon became clear that the ballpark was too small. In that thrilling 1911-1912 season, mostly the intense rivalry between the Red Sox Smokey Joe Wood, pitcher, and he, you know, just an otherworldly fastball, and the young ace of the Washington Senators, this was Walter Big Train Johnson. Their rivalry really put Fenway first to the test. Give us a snapshot of that melee.
Absolutely. They met on September 4th, 1912, in a matchup that fans all across the country looked forward to because both Joe Wood and Walter Johnson had great pitching streaks that year. Johnson's had just ended. Woods was still ongoing. They were widely considered the two best pitchers of the year, the best pitchers of the era. And the Washington manager threw down the gauntlet and challenged Joe Wood to pitch opposite Walter Johnson on this game on September 4th. So they accepted. Washington still had a faint chance for a pennant, so the game mattered as well. So many fans turned out at Fenway Park that day that not only did they line up in the outfield, which they often did with overflow crowds, and sit atop the left field wall and on advertisements that were on the left field wall, but they poured onto the infield, they took over the dugouts, and ended up watching the game within about 20 feet of the foul lines. The players...
And they kept selling tickets.
That's right. You can't stop selling tickets if people want to come to the ballpark. The players actually watched the game while sitting on the ground like sandlot kids. It was a terrific game. Joe Wood won 1-0. And as the park emptied, Red Sox management realized one thing. Fenway Park, less than a year old, was already too small. Mm.
So after that, another transformation, they added, it underwent its first renovation, actually, while the 1912 season was underway, and even just before the World Series.
Right.
And I guess there's no spoiler alert here. Everybody knows that the Red Sox actually did win an epic 8-game World Series.
Oh, absolutely.
So what role did the park play in that win?
Well, it was hugely important because after that game we just talked about, in 2.5 weeks, they added another 11,000 seats. And what that did was fully enclose Fenway Park for the first time and gave Fenway Park the familiar footprint that the park has now. Stands were extended down the left field line. The center field bleachers were connected to the right field stands by the right field bleachers. And sort of by accident, they created this odd footprint that Fenway has. The stands were still so far out that the shape was really of no concern. But what happened during the World Series that year is because they added these extra seats, for example, in left field, they put bleacher seats on Duffy's Cliff, mm-hmm. the retaining wall before the left field wall. They had to institute special ground rules. So if a ball was hit into the stands over there, it was a ground rule double. That also meant that if anyone would have hit the ball over the left field wall during the 1912 World Series, it would have been a ground rule double. It wouldn't have been a home run. So it really had a major impact on how the World Series was played. It shortened the outfield. The outfielders were able to play more shallow, so balls that otherwise would have fallen in for hits were caught at the shoe tops or outs.
Well, you know, it's funny to read about this, too. You know, one of those games in the World Series was decided with a coin toss where they would play the game. You know, and it's definitely not a gentleman's game. I'm not going to say that. There were some rough riders. But, you know, do you look back at this time and think, wow, oh, that's baseball.
Well, it was so rich. That's what I love about doing a book like this, is I can just bury myself in the data and in the stories and kind of lose myself in another time and really, in a sense, deliver another time to the reader. And that's a time period that many of them are not familiar with, but a time that still has a great deal of drama.
Okay, so we're talking about the very inaugural year of America's most beloved baseball park with Glenn Stout, author of Fenway 1912 and a number of other books. Glenn, we really can't resist a penultimate moment, or let's say a victory lap here. This is from a video taken by a member of the crowd. So sitting there in Fenway Park witnessing the final out of the 2004 World Series. It's worth the wait, 80 years. I still get chills listening to that. It's amazing. But you write that Fenway Park played this key role in the fortunes of the Red Sox against the World Series against the New York Giants. How about 2004?
Well, I think Fenway has always been sort of a secret weapon for the Red Sox. It's just quirky enough that they have a little more experience playing at it that's always helpful. You know, the left fielder knows how to field balls, hit off the left field wall, things like that. And then you have this crowd that's there, fills up the ballpark every night. And one of the things that I realized sort of after this book was written, and I've gone around talking to people, is a lot of people are Red Sox fans, but there's even a larger constituency of people who are fans of Fenway. Mm. On any given night, Fenway is about half full of people from out of town who may or may not be Red Sox fans, but love Fenway Park. And that's why in the city of Boston, you don't say you're going to see the Red Sox, you say you're going to Fenway.
Yeah, that's right. My dad grew up in Boston, and he went to Boston Latin, just very close to Fenway, mm-hmm. and he get out in the afternoon. He said at that time the bleacher doors were open and he just walked right in. And he said this was at a time when the Red Sox weren't winning, so it wasn't all that filled up. But he remembers sitting there watching Joe Cronin, Jimmy Fox. Now it's the most expensive park in the country. Will local kids ever have that kind of experience?
Well, you hope that they will. I mean, I hope there are still enterprising kids who sneak into the park, because that's what I did when I first moved to Boston in 1982. They'd abandoned the bleacher gates, the turnstiles, about the third or fourth inning. You know, I argue that Fenway is a place that can change your life because it changed mine. That was one of the reasons why I moved to Boston. And Fenway Park was my introduction to all things Boston, the history of Boston, the city itself, and obviously the Red Sox. So I hope that kids today, you know, Fenway Park is unique enough that you can still kind of dive into the history and the background and the mythology of it, even if you may not get to attend as often as you might have been able to in the past, and you can still have that same kind of unique personal experience. Fenway is different for everyone who encounters it, and that's because it's evolved over time, so that the park I first saw in 82 is a different park than the one your father first saw. But if your father and I were sitting across from one another, that starts a conversation because we've each seen Fenway Park through different eyes at a different time. And that's how Fenway gets kind of knit into the fabric of everyone's life.
Next year, the 2012 season, the enterprising Red Sox, of course, will want to be eager to be capitalizing on the 100th anniversary of Fenway Park. Anything you hope listeners would keep in mind during that celebration?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind, again, that personal connection that I just spoke about. And in this book, I had this experience a few weeks ago because I got to go to Fenway Park for the first time after I'd written this book. And I looked around Fenway Park, and even though I've been there hundreds of times, both as a fan and professionally, every place I looked, I suddenly had a new story, a different understanding of Fenway. It was literally like looking at the place for the first time. And I think that next year, a lot of fans will be able to have that experience through this book and others that have been done about the ballpark. You get to see Fenway Park, a place you know so well, like it's new. Brand new again. And I think that's going to be a very unique experience next year.
I can't resist asking. Bobby Valentine.
2-year contract says everything. I don't think he's going to be there very long.
I saw your tweet. You said he's hired to be fired. Couldn't resist. Glenn Stout, I want to thank you so much. What a delight to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I love doing the book, and I've loved speaking to people about it.
Glenn Stout is a sports writer and an editor of The Best American Sports Writing, and the new book, Fenway 1912, The Birth of a Ballpark, a Championship Season, and Fenway's Remarkable First Year. You'll find much more in the book and that beloved park at wordofmouthradio.org. Glenn is going to be reading tonight at Gibson's Bookstore in downtown Concord. There are details on the reading at wordofmouthradio.org. And how can we help but leave you with Neil Diamond singing Sweet Caroline?
Reaching out, touching me, touching you.
Are we going to do it? Are we going to do it?
You never
We're
know.
We're going to have to do it.
Good times never seem so good.
So good, so good, so good. You can join the Good Times on Facebook and Twitter. And coming up, Elvis Costello's advice on what not to buy this holiday season. That's in just a minute when Word of Mouth returns. This is NHPR.
And it don't seem so lonely. We fill it up with only.